Okay, let's do respiratory, and you've had most, if not all, of this already with our little friend, Pesso. He's not little, actually, he's bigger than me. Okay, should be. A lot better looking, too, right? Yeah. Really? That's nice. I like that. Wow. I'm blushing. Actually, I was baiting you for that. I was hoping you were going to say that. Well, that's cool. That was spontaneous, too. That was really, really good. I have to call, tell my wife when she calls. I said, I'm married. All right. God, that was nice. Okay. Now, you've had this stuff, but we'll just kind of do it a little bit again. And then when we get to restrictive and obstructive lung disease, I'll kind of give you a snippet that will remind you about the pulmonary function test that one would expect during those things. So don't worry, we'll do a little bit of that. We've done blood gases, so we'll do the pulmonary function test when they come up. This is not big A, as we see it over here. It's not PACO. This is a stupid slide. You do have to know about the AA gradient, guys. You have to know how to calculate it. Okay, sometimes they'll give you all the information that you need, and oftentimes the whole question is based on whether you calculated the AA gradient or not. Basically, remember, the alveolar oxygen and the arterial PO2 are never the same. So the difference between those two is called the alveolar arterial gradient, and there's reasons for it that Patsell mentioned. First of all, ventilation and perfusion are not evenly matched in the lungs, as you know. Remember, ventilation is better when you're standing up in the apex than perfusion, whereas perfusion is better than ventilation in the lower lobe. See, that explains why almost all pulmonary infarctions are in the lower lobe, because perfusion is greater than ventilation in the lower lobes. And it explains why reactivation TB is in the apex, because it's a strict aerobe and it needs as much oxygen as possible. So that's very important stuff that he taught you about that. Okay, so normally the alveolar oxygen is 100 and normally the arterial PO2 is 95, so normally the gradient's only about 5 millimeters of mercury. As you get older, that gradient expands a little bit, but not that much. Most people use as their upper limit of normal, in other words, setting it for very high specificity, 30 millimeters of mercury. If you have an AA gradient greater than 30 millimeters of mercury, you clearly and unequivocally have a problem, because that's set for very, very high specificity. Another term, positive predictive value. Okay? You truly have something wrong. So it's set for very, very high specificity. 30 is probably the magic number to remember. Now, the concept is very easy. And that is, you would expect the gradient between the alveoli oxygen and the arterial oxygen to be greater if you have primary lung disease. I mean, that's it. Okay, so you already know those things that would do it, because we talked about them already. Ventilation defects, okay, wouldn't that produce hypoxemia, yes or no? Certainly, so wouldn't that prolong the gradient? Sure, if you're dropping the PO2 and you're subtracting, there'd be a greater difference between the two. If you have a perfusion defect, wouldn't that increase the AA gradient? Absolutely, okay? Pulmonary embolus. If you had a diffusion defect, wouldn't that increase the gradient? Certainly. But what if I had depression of my respiratory center by barbiturates? Would that increase my AA gradient? No. So the beauty of the AA gradient is that it tells you in patients that have hypoxemia whether the hypoxemia is related to something wrong in your lungs, ventilation, perfusion, or diffusion defect, versus something outside your lungs that's causing the hypoxemia. Now, what are we talking about? Respiratory acidosis. Because if you have respiratory acidosis, then what automatically happens to your PO2? Goes down. And as you know, you can have respiratory acidosis and pulmonary problems, right? Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. But you can also have respiratory acidosis because you depress the respiratory center, Remember, you obstruct the upper airways with, let's say, epiglottitis, laryngotracheal bronchitis, cathé coronary, or you paralyze the muscles of respiration, you know, Guillain-Barré, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, whatever, okay? Those are all going to produce respiratory acidosis, hypoxemia, but the AA gradient will be normal. See, that's why that's important to know that. So always, when they're giving you a question that's dealing with AA gradient, always calculate it. If it's prolonged, then you know there's something wrong in the lungs. If it's normal, then you know there's something outside the lungs that's causing it, respiratory center depression, upper airway obstruction, or paralysis of the diaphragm. Very important. There's a couple things you should always calculate. Anion gap should always be calculated with electrolytes, and AA gradient should always be calculated when you get blood gases. Very simple calculations. All you have to do is calculate the alveolar oxygen. So we can do that right now. Right now, what we're breathing, what are we breathing? We're breathing 21% oxygen, so it's 0.21 times 713. Now, it's 713 because you have to subtract water vapor from 760. You multiply 0.21 times 713, that's 150. Okay, minus the PCO2, and that's given to you in a blood gas, okay, divided by 0.8, which is the respiratory quotient. So the normal PCO2 is 40, so 0.8 into 40 is 50. So what's 150 minus 50? 100, okay? So now that you've calculated the alveolar oxygen, you should just subtract from it the measured arterial PO2, voila, got the AA gradient. Okay, so it's very, very, very simple to do, and it gives you incredible amounts of information when you're working up hypoxemia. And they know that, and that's why they ask you questions relative to it. I remember even seeing a sample question on that exact concept. All right. Now I'll talk about some upper airway diseases. Nasal polyps. Very interesting. It's about three different types of nasal polyps. The most common is an allergic polyp. But guys, never think of a polyp in the nose of a kid that's allergic as being an allergic polyp. No. Allergic polyps develop in adults that have long-term allergies and allergic rhinitis. You don't see allergic polyps in kids. As a matter of fact, the board question was that a 4 or 5-year-old child had a nasal polyp in their nose. What was, of course it was in their nose because it's a nasal polyp. They said, what was your first step in management of the patient? The answer was sweat test. Because if you have a polyp in the nose of a kid, they have cystic fibrosis. Okay, so any child with a polyp in the nose needs a sweat test. It's not an allergic polyp. They don't need RAS testing, you know, looking for, not on the skin, looking for allergens in the blood and all that stuff. No. They need a sweat test. That was the question. Child had nasal polyp. They probably mentioned problems with, you know, respiratory infections. They would have to do that. I'd say, you know, what's your first step in management? The answer is a sweat test because they'll have cystic fibrosis. Okay, so remember that one. Allergic polyps, allergic polyp, no problem there. And then remember triad asthma. Triad asthma is where you take an aspirin or non-steroidal. Remember, aspirin is a type of non-steroidal. They get asthma, okay, and they have nasal polyps. Now, this one's kind of unfair, guys, and so we have to play their game by spilling the beans on how to answer the question. Because they don't tell you that the patient took aspirin, and they don't tell you that they have a polyp. And somehow, you have to figure out that aspirin's responsible. Okay? Here's how they do it. Okay? It's always a woman. I'm not making it. They always pick a woman because pain, in general, is more common in women than men. Okay? So they'll say the patient has headaches, chronic headaches. They'll say 35-year-old woman with chronic headaches. Or they can pick another one, fibromyalgia. Very, very, very common cause of pain in women, predominantly. Fibromyalgia, where they have all these pressure points of pain. Some chronic pain syndrome woman. They do not tell you she's on medication. And they'll say that she develops occasional bouts of asthma. And then they'll say the mechanism of this patient's asthma is. And the answer is she's taking non-steroidal. So look at all the stuff they left out. They left out the polyp in the nose. They left out the fact that she was taking any medication. But I think it's fair to say that if someone has chronic pain, they're probably taking some medication, which is usually a non-steroidal and or aspirin, Motrin or aspirin itself. So I think it's a reasonable assumption. And then they're saying that the patient has asthma. I think you can work your way into that. I really do. But that's the way they do it. Here's another one that you have to make an assumption on. These idiots on the boards think that any male that's well-built is on anabolic steroids. I swear to God, I will tell you, when we go through liver and GI, you wouldn't believe the things that you have to assume. You won't believe it. Okay, so they'll talk about a football player, they'll talk about a wrestler, and they'll talk about something that happens. You know, they get intraperitoneal hemorrhage. You have to assume they're on anabolic steroids. Anabolic steroids produce benign liver cell adenomas, which have a tendency of rupturing. Boom, there you go. It's all kinds of things you have to assume. Okay, so remember, any professional football player, any wrestler that they mention in any of these questions they give you, they're on anabolics. That's probably what the answer is going to be. Right there. Or any person with a chronic pain syndrome of any kind, male or female, that develops asthma, it's related to someone taking asthma, producing it. Now, you know how it works, don't you? What will aspirin or nonsteroidals block? Cyclooxygenase. So therefore, arachidonic acid can't form prostaglandins, but that leaves the whole lipoxygenase pathway open, doesn't it? And some people are very super sensitive to that. And so we have our little friends LTC, D, and E4 being formed, and those are potent bronchoconstrictors. Okay? And that's the reason why they develop asthma. It is not a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. That is a chemical-mediated, non-type 1 hypersensitivity type of asthma. Okay? So chronic pain, asthma, the reason for it is they have aspirin sensitivity. Okay? That's the answer to that one. So we got the polyp thing out. We got our cystic fibrosis thing out. Okay, laryngeal carcinoma, I'll show you a picture of momentarily. Like now. Okay. Now, when I show this picture to second-year medical students, they're entranced with this thing right over here. They think maybe this is the pathology. No, that is a piece of dirt on the slide. Okay. And students are amazing because they think that you're always trying to fool them. You're always trying to fool them. In reality, I'm not. Okay? Nor are they on the boards with pictures. You know, a lot of times I always watch students when I give exams and I put a picture up. I watch where their eyes are. Most of the time they're over here, sometimes up here, sometimes looking at the person next to them. Okay? But they're never where the pathology is. Guys, when you take a picture of a person, is the head in the picture? Yes or no? Okay. All right. So they try most of the time to put what it is you really, really want to emphasize roughly in the middle of the slide. So that's where you look. You don't look here, you don't look there, you don't look down there, and you don't look down there. Look somewhere in the middle. That's where the pathology is. Really? Do it here. What's in the middle? That. That's in the middle. It's so sad. I know. But what does that look like? It looks like a mouse. I think this one of the mouse. That small? I don't think so. But wait a minute. It's got little ears and this tail. But it's too small. And isn't a Minnie Mouse? No. All right. Not only that, they give you the vocal cords to compare this to. You see something there? And it's obliterated on that side. Oh, those were the vocal cords? See, some of you would say, yes. So, let's make sure you got your anatomy. What's that? A tongue? No, that's the epiglottis. Good Lord in heaven. Okay. So, that's true. That's not the tongue, which most of you thought. Okay. Then what's that? The false vocal cord. What's this little space in between? The commissure. What's this over here? The true vocal cord. So, the true's not before the false. False is first. Then it's the commissure, then that's the true vocal cord. The false vocal cord up is lined by squamous epithelium. The true vocal cord down is lined by ciliated pseudostratified columnar epithelium. Now this is laryngeal carcinoma, most common cause smoking. But they're into a concept, and that's synergism. Another, the second most common cause of squamous carcinoma of larynx is alcohol. So number one, smoking. Number two is alcohol. Well, what if you did both? Then you would develop, have a much greater chance of developing it. Do you understand the concept of that? That's called synergism. And they're into that. You know what I would do with this? I would say The lesion represented in this slide is laryngectomy specimen. Okay? Which of the following would have been the greatest risk factors for the lesion represented in this slide? And then I would have A, smoker. B, alcoholic. C, smoker and alcoholic. D, I don't know, some other thing. C? No. I know the answer is C. I'm thinking of B and E. Parachutist. Okay, whatever. Okay? So what's the answer? Is it A? Oh, yeah, that can produce cancer. Is that the answer? No. Is it alcohol B? No. How about alcohol and aspirin? Yes, because both of them can do it by themselves, but together, greater chance. That's true for any squamous cancer, from the esophagus to the mouth to the larynx. Anyone. Smoking is the most common cause of squamous cancers in the mouth and upper esophagus, as well as the larynx. And alcohol can do the same thing. So if you're a smoker and a drinker, you literally double your risk. So that's a very important concept. Most common symptom associated with this is hoarseness of the throat. Okay. So what's that? The epiglottis. And what can infect it? Haemophilus influenza. And what kind of symptom would you have? Inspiratory stridor. Okay, now, kid, 3 months, dies. I even hate to say that. And there's inflammation right down here in the trachea. And this kid had an inspiratory type of stridor. Diagnosis, croup, organism, parainfluenza. Very good. So it's a tracheal inflammation and parainfluenza, whereas epiglottitis is over here. Either one of them produces upper airway obstruction. Good. Okay, hyaline membrane disease. You can see why they call it hyaline membrane. Remember we said that anything that's got a lot of peak in it, what do we use the term? Hyaline arteriosclerosis, hyaline membrane disease. Another name, respiratory distress syndrome. Now, what is all this crap? That's collapsed alveoli. Because the key to understanding respiratory distress syndrome is massive atelectasis. So what's atelectasis mean? Collapse of airways. Now, why did these airways throughout both lungs collapse? Talk to me. No surfactant. Ooh. Give me a name for surfactant. Lecithin. Give me another name. Phosphatidylcholine. Give me another one. Phosphatidylglycerol. They're all surfactant. So, you're still not there yet. So what? So you're deficient in surfactant. Why would that cause atelectasis? Well, the answer is collapsing pressure in the airways is equal to surface tension in the numerator divided by the radius of whatever the airway is in the denominator. Okay, so collapsing pressure is equal to surface tension by the radius of that of the airway in the denominator there. Okay, so on expiration, what happens to the caliber of the airways normally? It's smaller, right? Because you have a positive So if you're decreasing the radius, then what would that do to collapsing pressure? Increase it. So therefore, on expiration, in all of us, why don't we have massive atelectasis of all of our airways on expiration? Okay, now think about it. What do we have that keeps them open on expiration? Well, what would we have to do to reduce collapsing pressure according to the formula? Collapsing pressure equals surface tension divided by radius. The radius is decreased, that increases collapsing pressure, so what do we need to have? We need to do what? Decrease what? Surface tension. So what do you think surfactant does? It decreases surface tension. You might as well know why rather than just memorize it. It decreases surface tension. That's what it does. And by doing that, it keeps your airways open on expiration, so you don't have atelectasis. Now, we know the three causes of respiratory distress syndrome are prematurity, because, as you know, surfactant begins synthesis early on, but it peaks at around the 32nd to 35th week. And so if you're born a little bit before that time, you don't have enough surfactant. And so you really run a significant risk, that little baby, for developing respiratory distress syndrome. Now, sometimes you have no choice. You've got to deliver that baby, otherwise they're going to die. And there's something you can do to mommy to make sure that that baby will have a little bit more surfactant. What are they going to do? They're going to give mommy glucocorticoids. Because glucocorticoids stimulate surfactant synthesis. That's on boards. But there was another question on boards that was very, very tricky. They were talking about things that increase surfactant, and everyone was looking for cortisol or glucocorticoids, and it wasn't there. I mean, they looked on different pages, they looked underneath, they looked in the back. It wasn't there. And so they wrote it in. A lot of them put F, you know, surfactant. I mean, it must have made a mistake. No, they wanted to see if you knew other causes that increase surfactant. And the answer is thyroxine. Thyroid hormone increases surfactant. If you want another one, prolactin does too. That's not in the notes, but I just learned that one the other day. The answer was thyroxine, also stimulates. Now, does that mean then you'd give mommy thyroxine, okay, before you delivered the baby? No. You want to give the mommy hyperthyroidism and the baby hyperthyroidism? No. You give her cortisol or glucocorticoids. Okay? That's that. So prematurity is an easy one. Diabetes. Mommy's a diabetic, or remember, it's gestational diabetes, a diabetic that's pregnant. No. Gestational diabetes is a woman who is not diabetic when she's not pregnant, and then she gets pregnant and then develops glucose intolerance. That's gestational diabetes. Now, if a diabetic gets pregnant, you don't call that gestational diabetes. It's a diabetic that got pregnant. Well, that's a difficult concept. Well, okay. Let's continue on here. Now, so what? Why is it so important that a woman in her pregnancy has good glycemic control? Because if she has hyperglycemia, so does the baby. And the baby has hyperglycemia, that's a stimulus for insulin release and it's prepped from his pancreas. And what does insulin do to surfactant synthesis? It decreases it. That's right. So then that baby's at great risk. C-section. Okay? Why would C-sections produce respiratory distress syndrome? Stress is missing. See, there's a benefit to being delivered vaginally. It's a good lesson for the newborn coming out too, actually. Life is stressful. There's nothing better than getting your head and body squeezed into an oblivion before you come out. See, that's why many babies who go through this thing and they come out try to go back in. Okay. Because they know, God, if it's going to be worse out here, I'd rather go back to where I was. I had a good hot tub. I was able to swim, kick my legs around. Why not go back? And not only that, my head feels like a cone. Okay, that's why all the hats that they give the newborns are shaped like this. Okay, because they fit the mold of the head. Okay. So when you deliver by C-section and then you pull a kid out and the kid has a round head. The kid has not been stressed. Therefore, ACTH and cortisol are not increased. Therefore, they're not making surfactant. As opposed to the kid that's getting annihilated by squeezing, okay, releasing all that cortisol. So a lot of surfactant being made on that way out. Okay, so C-section predisposes to respiratory distress syndrome as well. Now, there's a Goyon maneuver for C-sections, okay, and that is don't separate the cord away from the baby. Just grab the cord and hang the baby like this and go like, and kind of bounce him up a little bit like this. Now, you do this in a room with nobody there. And it stresses him a little bit, okay? And they like it, especially male babies. Male babies love to be manhandled. Now, little girl babies, they're really going to cry. Male babies, you know, they love it. Smile. You do that to a little baby girl, they go absolutely crazy. Okay, they don't like that stuff. I know this because I've tried it on both. Okay, and whatever. Now, those are three main causes of this. Now, another question is, why are babies of women that have poor glycemic control big? Macrosomia. Well, that's biochemistry. So we need to know why that is. Well, the answer is this. I'm thinking. Okay. Now, remember, the baby's insulin is increased to keep the glucose down. Is that correct? Okay, what does insulin do to fat storage? It increases it. Okay, you'll learn that in biochemistry. It increases the storage of triglyceride in the adipose. Where is most of your adipose located? Centrally. So one of the reasons why they have macrosomia is that insulin stimulates triglyceride synthesis and deposition in fat. So they are a little fatter. Two, what does insulin do to amino acids? Increases the uptake in muscles, kind of like growth hormone. And so it increases muscle mass too. So the reason for macrosomia, why they're 10 pounds and over, is that they have an increase in adipose and an increase in muscle mass due to insulin. This also explains why they frequently get hypoglycemia when they're born. Because it's mommy's hyperglycemia that's coming into the baby, causing the baby to release insulin. So the moment you deliver that baby and cut the cord, it's got all this insulin, and there's no more increase in glucose. Glucose goes down, and you can end up with hypoglycemia. So all of those things are important things to remember. Okay. Now remember, we already talked about the oxygen superoxide free radical damage producing retinopathy, prematurity, and blindness, and bronchopulmonary dysplasia. Why would it be that babies that have respiratory distress syndrome commonly have patent ductus arteriosus? Because they have hypoxemia, guys. Remember, when they take a breath, when a normal baby takes a breath, that starts the process going for functional closure of the ductus. But if they have hypoxemia after they're born, then it doesn't. It remains open. So they very commonly have machinery murmurs as well in these babies. The hyaline membranes, if you're interested, the hyaline membranes are due to degeneration of the type 2 pneumocytes and a little bit of leakage of fibrinogen, and it congeals to produce these membranes. But they could look. You could look at this. They can give you a classic history for respiratory distress syndrome. And then they're going to ask you a question of the mechanism. Which of the following is the pathogenesis of the hypoxemia in this baby? And remember, this is a massive perfusion defect, ventilation defect, or diffusion defect. What is it? Ventilation defect. Everything's collapsing. Okay, you still have perfusion. Okay, and so what's the main thing that's happening when you have a massive ventilation defect? Is it a dead space problem, or is it a shunt problem? It's a shunt problem. They have massive intrapulmonary shunting. So you can get all of this stuff, and you know the answer is respiratory distress, and then all of a sudden they're asking about the pathogenesis of the hypoxemia. And you say, and you write in, respiratory distress, as if the idiots are going to read your answer. No. You're writing on the computer screen, okay? No. They're asking about mechanisms. They already know that you're supposed to know it's respiratory distress, and there's something else about it. Okay, and so it's massive intrapulmonary shunting. Now, the way they treat this is PEEP therapy, positive end expiratory pressure, because these airways are collapsed, and you've got to get oxygen into them, and surfactant, which is synthesized. So what happens is you put them up to a respirator when they're getting oxygen, and you set it for a positive end expiratory pressure. Right at the end of expiration, you puff in some pressure, and that keeps the airways open on expiration so that you can keep oxygen in them. That's the purpose of that. And then they put in a little bit of surfactant, and so we get pretty good recovery rates in hyaline membrane disease now. So that's cool. All right. Oh, yeah, let me do this. This picture is on boards, guys. I want you to look at it. This is a type 2 pneumocyte. Okay? That's the nucleus. These are lamellar bodies. L-A-M-E-L-L-R. Lamellar bodies. Don't they look kind of like an onion cut in cross-section? Don't they kind of look like hyperplastic arteriolosclerosis, kind of concentric types of things? Well, these lamellar bodies contain surfactant. Okay, and this would identify this as a type 2 pneumocyte. They commonly do EM pictures of the lung. Usually with an alveolar macrophage in it. So you already know what a macrophage looks like. You know, a cell has got all these different junk in the cytoplasm. Now you know what a type 2 pneumocyte looks like. It's got these lamellar bodies in them. And they can ask, obviously, a great number of questions related to this. This is the repair cell, remember, of the lung. It's also the one that synthesizes surfactant. Okay? Okay, now in terms of ARDS, adult respiratory distress syndrome, essentially it's the same as respiratory distress syndrome in terms of pathophys, but it's usually neutrophil-related injury. It's not that you're not making surfactant because you're too premature or you have too much insulin, because there wasn't any inflammation in that slide at all, just a bunch of collapsed alveoli. Now, most common cause of ARDS is septic shock. But isn't this interesting? We've got a lot of most common things. So the most common cause of septic shock was E. coli due to sepsis from an indwelling catheter. We said that the most common cause of DIC is septic shock. And now we're saying that the most common cause of ARDS is septic shock. Because anyone that's ever been in an ICU knows that when you come in with septic shock, within 24 hours they're having dyspnea, that's their ARDS, and within 48 hours they're bleeding out of every orifice, that's their DIC. That is so common, it's unbelievable. So first day it's a septic shock, the second day you're in ARDS, and the third day you're in DIC, the fourth day you are in a, you know what's happened on the fourth day. You've got a lily on your chest, okay? Because that's three bad things, septic shock, ARDS, and DIC. Man, okay, you bring the lily in, don't put it on there, just stick it on their chest, because that's it, okay? That is just bad. All right, not that that's funny, but that's true. So interesting, that sequence, very, very important that you remember about septic shock. Well, whatever it is, what happens is that neutrophils will get into the lung in septic shock, okay? And what do? Is they start destroying all the cells in the lung, the type 1 pneumocytes, the type 2 pneumocytes, and so automatically surfactant goes down, see? And so then you get collapse, massive atelectasis, but it's neutrophil related. The neutrophils are destroying the type 2 pneumocytes, okay? And that's why they get it. The reason why they get the hyaline membranes in ARDS is because the neutrophils have to get into the lungs by going through the pulmonary capillaries, and so they put holes in them. As they get out of the bloodstream and get into the lungs, so that's why they use the term leaky capillary syndrome. They commonly use that term. And they will have protein and fibrinogen and crap like that get in there, and they produce hyaline membranes. So you can actually see hyaline membranes in ARDS. Okay, and you'll have massive collapse, and so the major pathophysiology is intrapulmonary shunting. So it's the same thing as RDS, except it's neutrophil-related. And that's pretty much it for ARDS. Very bad prognosis in that. Okay, now here's where we have some differences of opinion, apparently, in certain countries compared to this country, and that is in pneumothorax. Okay. Now, these arrows are pointing to the leading edge of a collapsed lung, or is it a collapse? We'll see. So we have spontaneous pneumothorax and tension. Okay. Now, the most common cause of spontaneous pneumothorax is a ruptured subpleural bleb. So you have the pleura, and right underneath it is this little bleb, this little air pocket, and it ruptures, and there's a hole in the pleura. Now what's going to happen if there's a hole in the pleura? That part of the lung is going to collapse. Why? Because what's keeping it expanded is the negative intrathoracic pressure. Negative intrathoracic pressure keeps your lungs expanded. DePasso told you that. So when you put a hole in the pleura, then the atmospheric pressure is not negative. It's the same as the air you're breathing. Okay? And so there's nothing to hold it open. So it collapses. Now listen, guys. When parts of the lung collapse, there are things that are going to take up the slack. And that one of them is the diaphragm. So if you collapse a part of the lung, the diaphragm is going to go up on that side to take up the space that's been left. Not only that, if there's a collapse over here, the trachea is not going to go to the opposite side like some of you think. The trachea is going to go to the side where there's space. So you have tracheal deviation to the side of the collapse. And the diaphragm is up. That's a spontaneous pneumothorax. Okay? Most commonly, subpleural bleb, usually tall males, and for some reason they have these blebs in the apex, and they rupture, and they get this disease. A lot of times you can also get it in scuba divers. Very commonly get pneumothoraxes too if they come up too quickly, and they can get ruptures of these blebs. Now, tension pneumothorax, here's the big one. Tension pneumothorax, guys, is totally different than a spontaneous pneumothorax. A tension pneumothorax is most commonly due to knife injuries into the lung. Or as was in Three Kingdoms or whatever, that Three King movie with our little friend, what's his name? George Clooney. It was a gunshot wound with some shrapnel. Now here's, how many of you fill your tires up with air? You don't, that's why you're having problems with your car. Okay? Okay? Now, when you fill a tire up with air, you like the air to go in, but not to come out. Is that correct? Good. That's what a tension pneumothorax is. Because in tension pneumothorax, there's a tear of the pleura that's a flap. A flap. So when you breathe in, the flap goes up, and the air goes into the pleural cavity, and on expiration, it closes. And so the air stays in the pleural cavity. So every time you breathe, the flap goes up, the air stays in there, and on expiration, it closes. So every breath you take, you're increasing and increasing and increasing the pressure in the pleural cavity. The lung hasn't collapsed. But then that increase in pressure starts pushing the lung and the mediastinum over to the other side. And when it pushes it, it's compressing the lung and it's producing compression atelectasis. It's not that it's deflated because of a hole. There isn't a hole. It's a tear that when the air went in, it went up like this, and the air went into the pleural cavity and it shut on expiration. And that positive pleural pressure is pushing everything over to the other side. And of course, that's going to push on the thin wall vena cava, superior vena cava, the thin wall right ventricle and right atrium. So you're going to compromise blood return and breathing, medical emergency. Even George Clooney knew that in the movie. So what did he do? He took this trocar with a stopcock, and he jammed it into here, and he opened up the stopcock, and it let all that air out. You can actually hear it. Relieved it. So the lung re-expanded. And they said every time that you feel like you can't breathe, just open the stopcock up. And it relieved the positive pressure. That's totally different than a spontaneous pneumothorax. So tension pneumothorax is like filling your tire up with air. Okay? The air can go in, but it can't come out. And what's the air going into? Your pleural cavity. And it can't get out of there, so it keeps on building up, building up, building up, building up, and it starts pushing everything over to the other side. That's a tension pneumothorax. And that's actually what's happening here, okay? This is lung over here. Notice that the diaphragm is down. If you have a positive intrathoracic pressure, guys, the diaphragm's not going to go up. That's a spontaneous pneumothorax. The diaphragm is going to be pushed down, and that's down, buddy. Because here it is on this side, buddy, and there it is on that side, buddy. It's going down, buddy. Okay? That's the difference between a spontaneous and a tension pneumothorax. Commonly misunderstood for some reason. I don't know why. Okay. Pneumonia. How many of you ever had pneumonia? Nobody. That's good. You're all healthy. That's wonderful. I guess it must be that your arms are so heavy that you can't lift them up. Okay. Well, there's two kinds of pneumonia, typical and atypical. Okay? Typical is you can wake up in the morning feeling good, then suddenly you got 105 temperature, productive cough, and you are hurting big time. Atypical is something where you have a slow and insidious onset of the pneumonia. You just kind of feel crappy over a couple of days. You're just feeling crappier and crappier and crappier. That's atypical. Now we have two other types of pneumonia, community-acquired and nosocomial. Nosocomial doesn't mean that you pick your nose and you get an infection. Okay, nosocomial means that you get it within a hospital where you pick your nose. No. Okay. The organisms are totally different, guys. If anyone were to get a pneumonia here, and it was typical, you have strep pneumoniae. If it was atypical, it is mycoplasma pneumoniae. But if you were in a hospital and got a pneumonia, it would be the organisms that are in the hospital, which are E. coli, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, NOSA, and Staph aureus. So that's what it would be, one of those three that you get the pneumonia. You're not going to get strep pneumoniae in a hospital. You're going to get the organisms that will colonize. You know, one of the dangers of being a doctor is being in a hospital. Because when you go in that hospital, it only takes 1 week in a hospital to get colonized by the bacteria. So you're carrying around E. coli, you're carrying around Pseudomonas, and you're carrying around Staph aureus. No wonder why there's so many stinking wound infections and stuff like that, because we're the ones that transmit the Staph aureus, because we got it from the hospital. And maybe we didn't wash our hands enough. Okay, so nosocomial infections are totally different than community acquired, which is strep pneumoniae for typical, mycoplasma pneumonia for atypical. Now listen carefully. The reason why, in typical pneumonia, why you have a productive cough is because you have exudate pus, you have signs of consolidation in your lung. Well, let me show you a picture so that you understand what I'm talking about. Okay, see this, we've seen this one on a smaller picture. See these little yellow areas? These are all microabscesses. These are areas of consolidation in the lung. Let me show you another one. This is a lobar pneumonia. This is totally a consolidation in the lung. All pus that's in your alveoli, and it's completely causing a consolidation in your lung. So in other words, when you have typical pneumonia, you have pus in the alveoli producing consolidation in that lung. Now, you all know the physical diagnostic findings of lung consolidation, I hope. They are decreased percussion note, yes. They are increased tactile fremitus, yes. Now, what the heck does that mean? That means when a person talks, even right now as I'm talking, I feel vibrations in my chest, my massive chest, I feel it. Okay, I can feel vibrations a lot bigger than yours because my chest is more massive. Okay, so I feel, I'm just trying to get you to laugh a little bit. So I feel some vibrations in my chest. Now, if I had a consolidation like that, let's say in my left upper lobe, I would have increased tactile fremitus there because it's a consolidation. So it would be much greater when compared to other sides. So increased tactile fremitus equals consolidation. Okay, two, I have an E to A sign. Okay, that's where you are listening to the area of consolidation and the patient says E, not you. You're not there listening saying E, 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 and expecting to hear A. Okay, the patient says E, and you hear A. Okay, that's called egophony. That's a sign of consolidation. Then there's whispered pectoriloquy. What does that mean? You whisper, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, no. The patient whispers 1, 2, 3 while you're listening with your stethoscope and you hear it loud as a bell. It's an area of consolidation. So decreased percussion, increased tactile fremitus, egophony, pectoriloquy equals what? Consolidation. Good. What if there was a pleural effusion overlying the lung? The only thing you would have is decreased percussion. Forget all the other stuff. That was on board, separating a pleural effusion from a pneumonia. Now, atypical pneumonias, guys, do not have productive cough like typical pneumonias. They don't have as high a temperature either. The reason why is they're interstitial pneumonias. They're inflammation of the interstitium. There is no exudate in the alveoli. That's why you're not coughing up a whole lot. And so that's why you have no signs of consolidation. Okay? And so you're not going to have increased tactile fremitus and E to A signs and all that kind of stuff with an atypical pneumonia. There's a major difference there. Guys, they describe all these things in the stem of the question, and you can get the answer to what the patient has just by knowing a physical diagnosis. And boy, they ask it big time. I'm not making all this up. They actually have this stuff on tests. All right, so let's go back here and look at a couple things. Here's the most common cause of typical pneumonia in the United States, strep pneumoniae. You better know this because this picture was on many boards. It's a gram-positive diplococcus. Another name is pneumococcus. They even want to know treatment. The treatment is penicillin G. I think any second-year medical student should know how to treat strep pneumoniae and pneumonia. So that's fair game on part one. Yes, it is. So this is your most common cause of typical pneumonia. Okay? Mycoplasma pneumoniae is the most common cause of atypical pneumonia, followed closely by chlamydia pneumoniae. And that's an interstitial pneumonia. Insidious onset, relatively non-productive cough, and no signs of consolidation. That's an atypical pneumonia. Very important that you know this. That's why I'm spending time on it. Okay, we told you this is bronchopneumonia. That would be most commonly due to strep pneumoniae if this was community acquired, and it is. And this is a lobar pneumonia here, and if this is in the community, that would be, again, most commonly strep pneumoniae. All right. This is what a lobar consolidation looks like on a chest x-ray. Okay, so you have all the signs of consolidation in this particular patient here. So there's a lobar consolidation right there. This patient had a strep pneumonia and pneumonia. All right, let's give you some a couple liners on some of these infections. Now, you should be up on these, actually, because you had micro. So I'll just hit some key things, okay? Rhinovirus, of course, is the most common cause of the common cold. Remember, they're acid labile. For some reason, they think that's important. I never quite understood what that meant, but what it means is you're never going to get a gastroenteritis from a rhinovirus because it gets destroyed by acid in your stomach. I finally figured out what that meant. Okay. You're never going to have a vaccine. That was another board question because there's over 100 serotypes of rhinovirus. Okay. You already know about, well, you don't. You know about parainfluenza. Respiratory syncytial virus is the most common cause of bronchiolitis. Now, remember, whenever you inflame small airways, you get what? Wheezing. Wheezing is always means small airway disease. And that's bronchiolitis is most commonly due to respiratory syncytial virus as well as pneumonia. So pneumonia and bronchiolitis are most commonly in children is respiratory syncytial virus. Influenza, you probably had all there is on that, but remember, they're interested in on influenza about the antigenic drift and shift and when you need a new vaccine. The way I remember drift versus shift, remember we have hemagglutinins and influenza viruses. They actually help attach the virus to the nasal mucosa. And then we have neuraminidase, they have, which bores a hole through it. Antigenic drift is kind of like watching somebody in front of you drive, and you see them maybe move into the next lane. That's a drift. That's a minor mutation in one of those two things. Hemagglutinin and neuraminidase does not require a new vaccine. But an antigenic shift means you actually change direction completely. That is a major mutation in either neuraminidase or hemagglutinin. Need a new vaccine. Remember, the vaccine is against what? A, B, and C, or just A? Just A. A is the big one. Good. Okay, so you know that pretty good. Rubiola, measles, we're not going to mention that. Chlamydia psitticae, that's the one that people that work with psitticine birds like parrots, turkeys, stuff like that. Chlamydia pneumoniae we talked about. Chlamydia trachomonas, common board question. Got a little kid, he's born, about a week later, he's wheezing. Big time, okay? He's got, looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger chest. He's got increased AP diameter. He's got a tympanitic percussion sound, wheezing all over. No fever, no fever. You notice that his eyes are kind of crusty, so you think he's got a conjunctivitis both sides. Remember, this is after a week. What's his diagnosis? Chlamydia trachomonas. And here's how the kid's coughing. You know what they call that? Staccato cough. So when you see that term on the board, it's staccato cough. That's that's chlamydia trachomonas pneumonia. Now, how did this kid get it? On the way out through an infected cervix on the mommy. Because remember, the most common cause of conjunctivitis in the second week is chlamydia trachomonas. Most common cause overall of conjunctivitis is inflammation from the erythromycin drops in the eye. But after 48 hours, it's GC. But in the second week, it's chlamydia trachomonas. So they pick it up on the way out, so they get the conjunctivitis, and then also they develop the pneumonia, which affects the small airways. They get wheezing, no fever, and they have that peculiar staccato cough. Guaranteed board question. Okay, we already know about those other ones. We already know about strep, staph. We don't need to talk about Haemophilus. No, Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas, remember, is a water-loving bacteria. So we see this in patients in ICUs and CCUs when on a respirator. Don't forget that. Very, very important. They are water-loving bacteria. And if they describe someone in an ICU that has a productive cough with green cod discoloration, you're giving away Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Klebsiella pneumoniae is famous in the alcoholic. But listen carefully. That's not to say that alcoholics can't get strep pneumoniae pneumonia. So how are you going to know it's Klebsiella versus strep pneumoniae? Simple. Here's what they'll say. You got a patient that's an alcoholic that has high spiking fevers, productive cough of mucoid appearing sputum. That's the tip off. Mucoid appearing sputum, because you know that the capsule of Klebsiella pneumoniae is very thick. And so when they say mucoid, they're tipping you off that that's Klebsiella pneumoniae. Okay, and that's how you know it's that versus strep pneumoniae. They love to cavitate Klebsiella pneumoniae, too, in the upper lobes, and so it's very frequently confused with TB. Ooh. Okay. So Klebsiella pneumoniae. Nocardia, forget, ectomy, Legionella, big time. Legionella is considered an atypical type of pneumonia, actually. You pretty much get a non-productive cough. You're very, very, very sick. It can kill you. In fact, I was here doing a board review a number of years back, and some people that went to Bermuda came back on one of these cruise ships, and about 10 of them got Legionella, and about 3 or 4 of them died. And it was from water coolers. Legionella is another water-loving bacteria, and it's in water coolers that we see it. And also, a new one recently, and I believe they're going to see it on boards, you know those mists that they have in grocery stores over the vegetables? Whoa, they found out that that's a common source for Legionella. Those mists. And sometimes some restaurants on hot days have that mist blowing over there to keep you nice and cool. What they're doing is throwing off Legionella onto you. Isn't that nice of them to do that? Okay. There was one very tricky question on Legionella, guys. Very tricky. They talked about a patient that had a classic atypical pneumonia. Knew it was that, by the way. Non-productive cough, the dead. They had low-grade fever. No problem. Then they said the patient had hyponatremia. Woo. Well, all of a sudden we go from the obvious mycoplasma pneumoniae, then all of a sudden, hyponatremia. Well, that just changed the diagnosis to Legionella. Because Legionella just doesn't infect the lungs, as you know. You can get liver disease, and you also get interstitial nephritis. So it infects the kidneys, and it knocks off your juxtaglomerular apparatus so that you get low renin levels, low aldosterone levels. And if you have low aldosterone levels, are you going to lose salt in your urine? Yep. And are you going to end up with hyponatremia? Yeah. Golly. Isn't that amazing? That was a part one board exam. Part one board exam, something like that. Hyponatremia, Legionella pneumophila. Good Lord in heaven. I guarantee you, most books don't even have that information in it. I had to look it up, and I did find it. Okay, it does produce interstitial nephritis, and it does produce hyporeninemic hypoaldosteronism with hyponatremia. Can you believe that? Well, you know, most people that don't know that are going to obviously get that wrong. Okay, but you guys now know hyponatremia, atypical type of pneumonia presentation, Legionella. It's usually treated with erythromycin, Legionella. Okay, we're going to go through some fungi. Ooh. There we're probably at. That'll be it for today. I'm going to go through systemic fungi. Guys, I can't tell you how important this is. Yes, I can. It's important. Okay, I guess I can tell you. Why can't I tell you? I have no idea why you said that. Okay? But I can tell you. Not only do you have to know them, you have to know how to recognize them. So, let's deal with this. Systemic fungi. You know, Candida, Histo, and all that kind of stuff. All right? Candida, you remember, you normally get via indwelling catheters. Okay, usually those that are like subclavian and candida, and you get candida sepsis. I'm not going to talk about candida. Okay, I want us to remember different areas of the country because it's going to help us figure out what the systemic fungus is. Okay, in the Midwest and the Ohio-Tennessee Valley area, which is very, very humid, histoplasmosis is number one. Wherever there are there pigeons in New York? Are there? Yes. Even though they brought in peregrine falcons, they haven't killed all the pigeons. What do they have? Cryptococcus. I say pigeon from now on. What do you say? Cryptococcus. Pigeon! All right. Pigeon! All right. Just want to make sure. And this just proved a Pavlovian experiment. Stimulus, pigeon, response, cryptococcus. See that? Okay. This is Pavlovian. This is excellent. Okay, pigeon. All right. Now, histoplasmosis, as I said, is kind of Ohio, Tennessee Valley, Midwest. In other words, where I am from, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Ohio. Histo. Histo, think starlings. Starlings are those little black birds with the yellow beak. They carry histoplasmosis. So do bats. And so they very frequently talk about the dude in the Midwest that goes cave exploring. And then he ends up with a non-productive cough, it's histo. But sometimes to screw you up, they use the term spelunkerer. A spelunkerer is an idiot that goes into caves. Okay? That's what a spelunker is. If you look in Webster's Dictionary, it says idiot that goes into caves. Okay? That's what the definition of. Sometimes they use big words to try to screw you up, like dysgeusia, lack of taste, zinc deficiency. Okay? Anosmia, lack of smell. Kallmann syndrome or zinc deficiency, that kind of stuff. Spelunkerer, that's someone that visits caves. And there's bats in caves, and in the dung of the bat is histo. So cave explorers in the Midwest, Ohio, Tennessee Valley area, bat exposure or starlings, think histoplasmosis. Okay. If you're talking about the southeastern United States, blastomycosis, that's where blasto is. Blasto produces skin infections and lung infections, blastomycosis. Let me show you some pictures, and I'll show you some clever ways to ask questions, all of which, of course, are in your notes. Now, if I say southwest, you say coccidioidomycosis. Now, what's considered southwest? New Mexico, Arizona, and Southern California. Please look at this slide, please. This is coccidioidomycosis. Okay, and this is what is called a spherule. And in that spherule are endospores. This exact picture was on boards. Here's the history. Listen to this. This is where they asked it. I'm going to give you two histories. One, in the Los Angeles earthquake of 1993, a number of people developed non-productive cough. What was the cause? The answer, coccidioidomycosis. Why? Because the arthrospores, the infectious agent of coccidioidomycosis, is in dust. And so when you get earthquakes, this dust that comes up, you breathe it in, you end up with the disease. I was there when that actual earthquake, I was doing a board review. Got shook right out of my bed, actually, 5 in the morning. I remember it clearly. And in thousands of people got coccidioidomycosis. So the boards took that and made a board question out of it. Here's your second cocci question. You got a guy that's an Indian artifact explorer. In the Sonoran Desert, so you had to know that the Sonoran Desert is in Arizona. And he was a cave explorer, so that kind of threw people off and said, cave, histo. Wrong. Histo's in the Midwest, not the Southwest. Okay? And developed a non-productive cough. Okay, answer, coccidioidomycosis. Lots of people picked histo because it said cave. It's too dry in the Southwest for histo to live, guys. All right, so this is coccidioidomycosis, spherule endospores. Now, this is Cryptococcus. Okay, what does that mean? Pigeon. All right. Cryptococcus kind of looks like Mickey Mouse ears. They notice that the yeast forms are narrow-based bud yeast forms. They kind of have this Mickey Mouse appearance. So Cryptococcus pigeons. Now, what are some clever ones on that the board said? Now, a New York executive, it said, that had pigeons roosting on the air conditioner, and the executive developed a non-productive cough. They said, what was it? The answer, Cryptococcus. Then they said that painters that were painting the Brooklyn Bridge, this was actually in the boards, developed a respiratory infection. Now, when I heard that they said, what the students said, they said that, I said, that's not fair. And I said, why? I said, because pigeons and starlings roost on bridges. He said, but they didn't ask that, Dr. Goyan. I said, oh. What did they ask? How would you treat it, is what they asked. And so it was either histo or crypto. It didn't matter which one it is. How do you treat each one? Actinomycin. That's right. That was the answer. They could also do it and just leave out one or the other. In other words, they could put crypto in it, leave out histo, or put histo in it and put out crypto. Because bridges are famous roosting sites for both starlings and pigeons. Are these clever questions? Very, very clever questions. This picture is on boards, guys. Better look at it. This is an oil-powered... Wait a minute. What's happening to the time here? So we'll just do this now. This is an oil-powered or oil magnification. This is an alveolar macrophage, and these are the yeast forms of histoplasmosis. They're the only systemic fungus that has yeasts phagocytosed by macrophages. They're right here. Okay. We'll finish this off tomorrow. We'll do also GI and liver tomorrow.